Good evening, and welcome to the local news. Today is Friday, March 27th. I'm Gabriel Zucker, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, group seeks voter approval of Humboldt Police Oversight Board. Caltrans District 1 weekly radio PSAs between March 27th and April 2nd. And Ray Hamill with the sports report. Stay tuned, those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Sinkyone, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection that these tribes have to this region.
Humboldt County Board of Supervisors has been asked to approve a ballot measure for the November election that would create a policing oversight board. Daniel Mintz reports.
A group of Humboldt County residents are lobbying for a ballot measure that would create a Sheriff's Policy and Practices Board to review and advise on policing issues. During the open public comment period of the March 24th Board of Supervisors meeting, several residents asked that a proposed voter-approved ordinance creating the new Policing Advisory Board be discussed on a future agenda. Caroline Griffith, the former executive director of the North Coast Environmental Center, noted that the county's grand jury has recommended creation of a county civilian oversight board and an inspector general's office to review critical incidents involving the sheriff's office. She talked about her group's proposal and what it seeks to do.
The residents of Humboldt County deserve professional monitoring and accountability of their public agencies, especially the powerful and influential sheriff's office. So I am here today on behalf of a group of Humboldt County residents who agrees with this report and the recommendations, and we want to make your job easier for you. We have drafted an initiative, which I have passed out to you all, and I also emailed all of the supervisors last week. This would establish a Humboldt County Sheriff's Policy and Practice Board, which would be aligned with the recommendations of the grand jury report and similar to the City of Eureka's Community Oversight on Police Practices Board. So it would have subpoena power. It would also be subject to the Brown Act and all public meeting laws. The board would serve as an impartial and objective independent body that audits and assesses community complaints, jail conditions, budget and spending, and certain specified critical incidents involving members of the sheriff's office. So much like the City of Eureka's Community Oversight and Police Practices Board, this board would focus on policy and practices of the sheriff's department and make recommendations.
Griffith asked supervisors to agendize the proposal and approve it in time to qualify for the November election. Cal Poly Humboldt student Amy Scott said civilian oversight is especially relevant at this time.
What I appreciate most about this ordinance is that it recognizes that true public safety depends on institutions that are responsive to and duty-bound to the people that they serve. Independent oversight combined with real investigatory authority and transparent reporting creates the conditions for accountability that's fair and effective. And transparency is the fastest path to building trust and repairing relationships that have been strained over time. I think it's important to also acknowledge that we're in unprecedented times of state overreach. While our sheriff's office can no way be compared to like what we're seeing with the police brutality with ICE agents, I think it's just important to recognize that a lot of people just see police as police. And so any place where we can increase transparency and increase community participation in these types of engagements is really a great opportunity for us to feel more connected as a community.
Other speakers included Sierra Braggs, who works with, quote, people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, including people on the autism spectrum, who are, quote, terrified of encounters with law enforcement because any time that they deviate from what is prescribed, literally their life is in jeopardy. She said an oversight board would be helpful in reviewing sheriff's office policies and training requirements. A speaker who described herself as, quote, somebody who has been personally affected by police violence and brutality, said an oversight board would enhance transparency and accountability. Eureka's Community Oversight on Police Practices Board has been in place since 2022, and City Council member Leslie Castellano described it as a success.
I think you all were aware of the successes in the city of Eureka, in which this has brought greater transparency, as well as public engagement and public trust of law enforcement. And I think that's something we can all get behind, is that the relationship, like, trust is meaningful, and that trust requires community engagement and opportunities for serious public discourse. A ballot initiative would do just that. Generally bring greater professionalism. This is the way that law enforcement is moving, and support democratic processes.
Griffith had given the board clerk copies of the proposed ballot measure for supervisors to consider. Board Chair Mike Wilson said he wanted to set expectations on supervisors' responses, saying open public comment periods aren't for back and forth exchanges. As such, supervisors didn't respond to what was said. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
This is a Caltrans Sister Juan Road Information Bulletin for Humboldt County State Highways for the week beginning Friday, March 27th. On 36, expect up to 15-minute delays near Carlotta. Slide removal continues west of Grizzly Creek Redwood State Park. Check Caltrans Sister Juan social media for updates. Expect delays near Deerfield Ranch Road on the 2nd. Expect delays west of Maple Grove and at the Butte Creek Bridge. On 96, expect delays north of Willow Creek at the Tish Tank Campground and in Hoopla. On 101, expect delays near Stone Lagoon on the 27th. On 169, expect up to 15-minute delays at Martin's Ferry. On 254, expect delays north of Wyatt. On 299, expect up to 10-minute delays near the East Fork Willow Creek Bridge on the 27th. For Delaware County, state highways for the week beginning Friday, March 27th. On 101, expect delays south of Klamath from Klamath Beach Road to the Humboldt County line. Expect delays near the High Prairie Creek Bridge. Expect up to 10-minute delays at the Dr. Fine Bridge. For Lake Mendocino County, state highways for the week beginning Friday, March 27th. In Lake County on 20, expect up to 10-minute delays in Lucerne from Grove Street to Ogden Road. On 29, expect overnight delays in Middletown at Wardlaw Street. In Mendocino County on 1, expect up to 10-minute delays south of Elk. Expect up to 30-minute delays south of Westport at the Blues Beach Trailhead to the Overlook. Expect delays at the Wages Creek Bridge and near the Juan Creek Bridge. On 20, expect delays east of Fort Bragg. On 101, expect up to 10-minute overnight delays in Hopland. Expect delays south of Willits and north of Liggett. On 128, expect up to 10-minute delays at Junction Route 1 and from Flint Creek Road to Navarro Ridge Road. On 162, expect up to 10-minute delays east of US 101. For further updates, join us on social media via Caltrans District 1.
And Ray Hamill brings us details of all this week's big local sports stories, including a look ahead to the upcoming Big 5 and Little 4 in baseball and softball, as well as the latest high school and college baseball and softball news and why it was a big week for some local athletes in the college ranks.
The local high school baseball and softball seasons are heating up, with conference play set to begin next week. Hello and welcome to this week's KMUD News Sports Report. I'm Ray Hamill with HumboldtSports.com. We'll have more on the upcoming races for conference championships in just a moment, as we take a look at all of the big local sports stories of the week, including all the latest high school baseball and softball news, some college baseball and softball, and how some local athletes are faring in the college ranks this spring. But first up, the Big 5 and Little 4 conferences get underway next week in softball and baseball. And the Little 4 baseball schedule begins with a pair of huge matchups between the two conference favorites. Defending champion St. Bernard's will travel to Ferndale on Tuesday, with the two schools playing a second game at Crusader Field 2 days later. Both teams are undefeated heading into this weekend. The Wildcats are 8-0 after a dominating 13-0 win at Calistoga on Wednesday, and they look well up to the challenge in this year's Little 4 after an impressive early season, which included a thrilling comeback in the championship game at last week's Maxwell tournament, as they rallied from a late 0-7 deficit with 9 runs over the final 2 innings. The defending conference champion Crusaders, however, have been every bit as impressive and are 6-0 going into a weekend doubleheader against Arcata. The SB boys won all 3 of their games at last weekend's Wairika tournament, including a 13-2 win over Lassen in the final. Also in the Little Four next week, Sandfork and Hoopa will play each other twice, opening in Hoopa on Tuesday and playing in Miranda 2 days later. The Cubs are 4-6 after going 2-1 at last weekend's Fort Bragg tournament, including a 5-3 win over Hoopa, while the Warriors are 4-3. On Tuesday, the Hoopa boys traveled to Trinity and won 18-1 in their final pre-conference game. In the Big Five, meanwhile, Eureka and McKinleyville are considered the front-runners in the race for this year's championship. The Loggers are 8-4 after sweeping a doubleheader at home against Rancho Cotati on Saturday. The Eureka boys won 2-1 and 8-4, and they opened the Big Five with a home doubleheader against Fortuna a week from Saturday. The McKinleyville boys have not played in almost 10 days since losing 16-1 to Ukiah in the final of the Montgomery tournament. That, however, was their first loss of the season, and they are 7-1. The Panthers will have an opening round bye in the Big Five before beginning play against Fortuna on April the 8th. In the meantime, the Panthers will continue their preparation for league play when they travel to play Enterprise on Wednesday. Also in the Big Five next week, defending conference champions Del Norte open with a doubleheader at home against Arcata. The Warriors, who will play their final pre-conference games at the Hidden Valley tournament this weekend, are 3-4, while Arcata is 5-5 after sweeping a midweek doubleheader at South Fork, winning 12-1 and 14-1. In Big Five softball, meanwhile, the Fortuna Huskies look like one of the teams to beat after starting the season 10-0. The high-flying Huskies won all three of their games at last weekend's Cloverdale tournament, including a 7-0 win over the host school in the championship game. They followed that with a doubleheader sweep at Fort Bragg on Tuesday, winning 6-0 and 19-1. The Huskies will open conference with a doubleheader at Eureka a week from Saturday. The Loggers are 3-3 after sweeping a doubleheader at South Fork on Thursday, winning 7-3 and 11-8. After going winless last year, the Eureka girls look much improved this season and have now won three straight games. Also on opening day in the Big Five, Arcata travels to play two games against defending conference champs Del Norte. The Tigers are 6-2 after a 10-5 win over Ferndale on Thursday evening, while the Warriors will carry a 7-3 record into league play. The McKinleyville girls will have an opening round bye in conference and are 4-1 heading into a weekend game against Windsor. The Panthers will begin conference play at home against Fortuna on April the 8th. In the Little Four, meanwhile, defending conference champs South Fork could be the team to beat again this year. The Cubs are 4-6 after dropping the two games against Eureka on Thursday, but they have played some tough competition early in the season, with four of their losses coming against Big Five schools. The South Fork girls opened the Little Four with a doubleheader at Hoopa on Tuesday. The Hoopa girls are 6-4 after winning three straight games this past week, including a doubleheader sweep at Trinity. After losing at Arcata on Thursday, the Ferndale girls are 4-1, and they will try to get back to winning ways when they play a doubleheader at Calistoga on Saturday before opening conference play at home against St. Bernard's on Tuesday. In local college baseball, College of the Redwoods won a marathon 13-inning game at Butte 17-16 to open a three-game series last weekend, but would drop the next two games to the Roadrunners 19-6 and 7-4. Sierra is now 2-12 in conference and 4-23 overall. In softball, the CR women dropped their first four conference games last weekend. They lost 9-0 and 11-0 at Lassen on Friday and followed that with 15-3 and 9-3 losses at Feather River the following day. Redwoods is now 7-12-1 overall. The Cal Poly Humboldt women were also in action last weekend and won three of their four games against Cal State Dominguez Hills in their first home games of the year. With the three wins, the Jacks improved to 4-4 in conference and 13-16 overall. They will continue conference play with four games at Cal State East Bay this weekend. And rounding out another busy week in local sports, it was a good week for a couple of former HDNL athletes. Former St. Bernard's Crusader Caden Lee hit two home runs for Simpson University against Caltech as the Redhawks stretched their winning streak to six straight games. For the season, Lee is hitting .279 with 11 doubles, 5 home runs and 29 RBIs. Also impressing in the college ranks this week was former Eureka Logger and Big 5 MVP Kira Morris, who pitched 5 5 shutout innings for the Concordia softball team in a 5-0 win over Chaminade. Morris has appeared in 13 games this season for the PacWest leaders, including 7 starts, and she is 6-1 with an ERA of 1.79 and 1 save. And that's this week's KMUD News Sports Report. Until next time, I'm Ray Hamill with HumboldtSports.com.
In state news, bill in Congress supports National Parent and Youth Helpline. Public News Service's Suzanne Potter reports.
Today, California Congresswoman Norma Torres is reintroducing the National Parent and Youth Helpline Act, which would codify and greatly expand the service. The bill would dedicate $20 million a year for 5 years to the program, which aims to help the 174 million parents and kids in the U.S. Dr. Lisa Pion Berlin is president and CEO of Parents Anonymous, based in L.A., the organization that runs the free helpline.
So the helpline will connect people to another human being, a trained clinician, to provide evidence-based emotional support on any issue, with a focus on preventing child abuse and neglect.
People can call or text the helpline 24/7 at 855-427-2736 or live chat on the group's website, nationalparentyouthhelpline.org. The bill would also fund online support groups. Pion Berlin says the helpline has served more than 77,000 callers since it started in 2024 and has provided resources to more than 1 million people on a range of issues, including depression, financial problems, bullying, community violence, suicidal thoughts, and more. Representative Torres first introduced the bill in 2024, where it sat in a House committee. She spent 17 years as a 911 dispatcher in Los Angeles and says parents and kids out there are hurting.
It is critically important. We can avoid calls to 911. We can prevent child abuse, and we can prevent police officers from having to respond.
The bill would allow the existing helpline to hire more trained counselors to answer the phones, which Torres says would reduce wait times. Right now, it's estimated that up to 40% of callers get frustrated and hang up while on hold. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
In national news, Minneapolis activists file a wave of lawsuits against ICE alleging constitutional rights violations. KPFA's Kennedy Cuello reports.
Civil rights attorneys have filed 10 lawsuits against Immigration and Customs Enforcement and the Department of Homeland Security in what they describe as a first wave of complaints. The majority of the plaintiffs were protesting following the death of Renee Good and Alex Preddy in Minneapolis. The plaintiffs described the events that drove them to file the lawsuits at a news conference Thursday. Sarah Allen, one of the plaintiffs, says while she and her husband took to the streets with their community, agents escalated the situation.
In the chaos of it all, after they had deployed chemical gas into the crowd indiscriminately and without warning, Matt and I got separated as we tried to retreat. And next thing I know, I'm hearing commotion behind me. I'm hearing the sounds of a man's voice crying out. And when I turn around to see what was happening, all I can see is a group of masked agents violently assaulting my husband.
Plaintiffs said that following the attacks on their community by ICE, they felt the need to protest. William Kelly, another plaintiff, is a combat veteran and activist who has been protesting what he called attacks on the Constitution in other cities. He called the agents evil, saying that he witnessed multiple violations of constitutional rights. He said he was put in a chokehold with an agent putting their knee to his neck, which is a felony in Minnesota.
They put me in a cell with other citizens, one of which had been pepper sprayed, had been OC sprayed. So we sat in that cell for hours, choking on the fumes of that OC spray. They took our cheek swabs. They took our fingerprints. They never read us our rights. They never told us why we were there or what we were charged with. After several hours, I was released with a little citation, a piece of paper, but they never charged me. They never charged me with a crime, but they stole away my rights. So we're going to continue to stand up for these people, immigrant and citizen alike, because we believe in the Constitution, because we believe in humanity.
The 10 plaintiffs will be represented by various civil rights attorneys, One is Chase Ironize, a lifelong advocate for Indigenous rights and director of the Lakota People's Law Project. He says that as we approach the 250th anniversary of the founding of the United States of America, we need to defend the rights that the country was built on.
This is a popular democracy. It's a constitutional republic, but we, the people, have superior rights. So if we witness, like we did here, ICE engaging in illegal activity, unconstitutional activity, like when they dragged that Hmong man out of his house, that's a violation of the Fourth Amendment. When they snatch and grab people just for constitutional observing, that's a violation of our First Amendment, and we can't stand for any of it.
The lawyers say they expect these lawsuits will be in the courts for years to come. For KPFA News, I'm Kennedy Cuello.
Trump says Iran begging for peace deal as war continues. KPFA's Christopher Martinez reports.
President Donald Trump held his first cabinet meeting since the start of the war on Iran. And of course, the war was one of the topics on the agenda.
We have done an amazing job. I had to do a little stopover. I call it an excursion. I had to do a little stopover in Iran, and we had to knock the hell out of them.
The cabinet meeting comes after Iran rejected Trump's 15-point peace plan, instead offering its own 5-point plan. Trump denied reports that he is desperate to reach a peace agreement, saying that Iran is, in his words, begging to make a deal.
They want to make a deal. The reason they want to make a deal is they have been just beat to shit.
He dodged questions about when the Strait of Hormuz will reopen to shipping, but he had some harsh words for allies that have been reluctant to join in Trump's war.
I've done a great favor for the world. The world has not been, it has not been reciprocal, because when I told NATO where we give billions and billions of dollars, trillions over the years, I said, do you mind coming up and giving us a little hand with the Straits? Send up some, they didn't want to get involved. And I believe that's going to cost them dearly.
He also said a lot of people were big NATO people. I was never big. Meanwhile, the war seems set for another escalation, with the U.S. and Iran hardening their positions on talks and thousands more U.S. troops approaching the region. Missiles continue to fly over Iran and Israel. France's defense ministry says 35 countries have joined military talks on reopening Hormuz shipping. In the ministry's words, once the intensity of hostilities has sufficiently decreased. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky is in Saudi Arabia offering anti-drone help. And from the United Nations, warnings about health risks from the war that could last for decades. Kaveh Madani is director of the United Nations University Institute for Water, Environment, and Health.
You've got to be, of course, worried about the emissions resulting from the war, the warfare. Like all the airstrikes are affiliated with high levels of pollution or emissions, let's say. All the equipment that has been produced, all the missiles, drones, everything, all of those are operated using fossil fuels, but they also involved a lot of pollution when they were produced.
Mohammed Mahmoud, also with the Institute, worries about the long-term impacts.
The damage environmentally will take longer to address, certainly if it's in the waters. We have a lot of this debris, you have a lot of this release of contaminants in the water, heavy metals or toxic metals that go down towards the surface. I doubt those will be addressed soon, and in some cases, not at all.
Warnings and negotiations aside, the war goes on with no end in sight. And life goes on in its various ways. In Trump's cabinet meetings, amid discussions of war and big issues of the day, Trump took a moment to bring up another topic that is important to him.
I'm the only president that ever took a cognitive test. I took it 3 times. It's actually a very hard test for a lot of people. It wasn't hard for me.
Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
In National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A bill in the California legislature seeks a formal apology to Native Americans for the state's role in atrocities committed against Native people during the formation of the state, including forced removal from their lands, bounties for their heads, and other violence. Native American Assembly member James Ramos introduced the bill seeking the apology from the legislature and courts. The bill also requires a plaque to be displayed in the state capitol to memorialize the apology. Ramos notes Governor Gavin Newsom issued a formal apology in 2019, but the legislature and courts have yet to apologize, which he says is a stain on California's history. He says California's first people deserve an apology for the harm they endured and the generational trauma that continues today. The bill is supported by tribes and Native organizations in the state. You can count on it like the steady beat of a Native drum. Once a week, Yupik dancers fill the lobby at the Alaska Native Medical Center in Anchorage to lift the spirits of patients. And as KMBA's Rhonda McBride tells us, the kids are the ones to watch.
These days, we mostly see Alaska Native dance groups on a stage. But in the hospital lobby, the dancing is not meant to be a performance. Instead, a shared experience. The rhythms are almost hypnotic. Yet the dancers are fully present. Everyone is seated within a circle of sound and motion that spirals out from a small group of drummers.
In Yupik, we say you rock, not dance.
Kyle Watson is 12 years old, a sixth grader. He's here every Wednesday. His movements are sharp and precise, as if every fiber of his being snaps to the beat of the drum.
It just makes me happy.
Once Kyle is here, he says, any anger or sadness fades away. The Yuchak demands his full attention.
I keep on learning more about Yupik words, and I keep on learning more about dance motions, too.
And then, it's as if he's channeling something from another time and place. The excitement that comes out of Kyle's throat comes from way down deep. A throwback to a technique his ancestors used to excite the dancers and encourage them to pick up their pace. Kyle's grandfather, Percy Alexi, usually stands in the back of the room to watch.
I'm proud of him. He makes it fun. And I'm proud to say he taught himself.
Kids in their most pure form can do anything, and they could never do wrong.
Asi Gayakayak says this dance gathering is going on its 16th year, and by far, the best part is watching kids like Kai. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
And this is my final sign-off for National Native News. After more than 20 years at Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, I'd like to thank all the tribal and public radio stations, stringers, and especially to the listeners. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Bianna Federico, and thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Ray Hamill, Suzanne Potter, Kennedy Cuello, Christopher Martinez, and Antonio Gonzalez. KMUD News Online, you can find us on kmud.org. And now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have any questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward. the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Gabriel Zucker.